1 year ago tomorrow, lightning struck a tree on Mount Charleston, and it sparked a fire that burned for weeks. The Carpenter One fire consumed nearly 30,000 acres, sent plumes of smoke into the valley, and it forced the evacuation of hundreds of mountain residents. Firefighters finally put out the fire 8 weeks after it started, but that wasn't the end of the story. Since then, human residents have had to contend with torrential flooding, and animal species face an environment that has changed drastically since the fire. So we're going to look back a year ago tomorrow on the fire and look forward to determine what the future holds for the community. Joining us first is Becky Grismanoskis, who is a resident of Mount Charleston. Becky, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, the Carpenter One fire started on July 1st. What did you think when you first heard there was a fire on the mountain?
We saw the smoke. We live in Upper Rainbow, so we saw the smoke, knew that, you know, it was a lightning strike, or assumed it was. And but then it was still there that night, and then it was there the next day. And then you could see the smoke growing. And 4th of July, we had people up, had a barbecue. Most of the people on the mountain, I would assume, were out on their decks at the time. It literally exploded, the fire. It just, to see smoke is one thing. To see real fire is another.
What did you make of that?
I mean, I was terrified.
You got guests on the 4th of July, and suddenly all this pops up.
Some of them were from the mountain, so because most of us don't leave the mountain over the 4th only because of the potential for fireworks, and we try to do our part in watching out for the forest. And so we've had fires up there before, and my husband and I, quite honestly, have never evacuated. And I'm really not embarrassed to admit that, because my husband's retired Clark County Fire did more than his share of helping, and so on and so on.
Yeah, so you've never evacuated, but this time was different.
This was different, I told my husband, I said, no, this is, we have to go. He did not want to go, but I knew we had to go. So it probably took us an hour, hour and a half to get our animals all boxed up and in the car. And when you live on the mountain and you have the fear of fire and there's the threat of fire, you need to have an emergency kit with your important documents, which I've got. In fact, I just checked it the other day because it's almost July. And I grabbed that and, of course, you know, some clothes, and away we went.
Were you and your husband, as you left, afraid you might lose your house?
Yes. This time I thought we could. Yes, I did.
The firefighters put the fire out completely by mid-August, but then a month later, flooding.
Yes.
Describe the flooding that you and your neighbors experienced. I mean, what happened in this case as you looked around?
September 1st.
September 1st.
Was the day of the flood. Well, actually, you know, you have to give so much credit to so many agencies. And in this case, I'm not saying it because they're sitting here, but in this case, it's truly U.S. Forest Service, and the ones who are not here, Nevada Division of Forestry and the Volunteer Fire Department. Because when we were brought back to the mountain and we were allowed to move back, and there was still smoke in the canyon and it was eerie because there was hardly anybody up there, the first thing these agencies did was notify all the people that were back on the mountain that we needed to have a meeting at the Volunteer Fire Department station, Station 81. Which we did. And they began talking to us about the potential flooding that was going to happen. We're like, flooding? We live on a mountain. Why would you ever think that you would have to worry about flooding? We never did, ever. We're up 7,800 feet, our house. So they began telling us why. They had videos. They had graphs, charts, handouts. They were trying to prepare us for what could happen. But honestly, I'm just being honest about this. I didn't scoff at it exactly, but I'm like, oh, brother, you know, we live at 7,800 feet. Why would we be flooded?
So it sounds like it prepared you in some ways, but in other ways, you were still thinking, this is not going to happen.
Well, we were prepared only in that the weekend before we had before the September 1st, we had a minor flood, which we had never had ever, and it was pitch black, the stuff that was coming down from the fire. And it filled up this enormous well that we had, a well meaning a hole for a tree. Because, you know, you try to save the trees, so you take out dirt that surrounds it. Filled up this whole thing. So we now are thinking, oh. And everybody, the community got together through the advice of all these agencies and the help of the water district and all kinds of agencies with sandbags. NDOT helped. They got the sand. So, I mean, you know, you just couldn't ask for better people on this mountain. So everybody started getting sandbags. My husband and I got 400 sandbags. 400.
400 of them. And then the 1st of September.
1st of September, 10:30 on a Sunday morning. And you can only thank God that 157, the road to the mountain, Kyle Canyon, was still closed because it was destroyed from the previous weekend. That's where the flood went. So, okay, so now you don't have as many people on that mountain, visitors, hikers, the people that, you know, enjoy coming to the mountain. Thank God. Mm. So I walk out because it had been raining, and I see this wall of water, black, pitch black, coming down Rainbow, our street. And I just, you know, we're getting ready to watch NASCAR, so I just couldn't believe my eyes. Step back in the house. I'm on the deck. And I said, Duffy, oh, my God, come out. He did. The two of us look up and coming right at us, right down this, what at one time was a ravine, now was another ravine. And here it came, and it was, I'd lie to you, 12, 14 feet. I think these guys will verify that that's how big this thing was. And when it hit, took my husband's truck out of the driveway, sent it, you know, it went down Rainbow, it was destroyed. My car was still in the driveway, but got destroyed from all the plummeting. When all was said and done, we had 3.5 to 4 feet of rock and gravel from one end of our yard to the next. You couldn't even get our driveway. Mm.
This sounds like it was a whole lot worse than the fire.
It was. Just awful. Yeah. I don't know if I had a pick. I don't know.
Becky Krismaneskis has been talking about the U.S. Forest Service, among others, helping in that area. And Randy Swick is with us. He is the U.S. Forest Service Manager for the Spring Mountain National Recreation Area. Randy, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Dave.
So take us back to last year. And, you know, you're seeing some of what Becky's seeing. What went through your mind when you first heard about the fire?
Well, admittedly, you know, we had several fires prior to that. This one just happened to occur in a very remote part of the unit, very difficult to access and get troops to, somewhat limited on air resources because of a more major fire just south of us. And given the tender dry conditions, which we have again this year, as a matter of fact, our indices are even more advanced than they were last year. Once that got a little bit of wind on it and sun and so on, it just took off. And Becky's description is pretty accurate. I mean, for the next 10 days, basically, it burned 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 acres a day, rapidly chewing through some of the older mature trees on the mountain there, particularly in the pinyon juniper.
Now, a year ago today, the Yarnell Fire in Arizona killed 19 hotshot firefighters. And given the proximity, you know, it's a day later that the lightning hits, and it's 4 or 5 days later that you realize it's worse. That must have been right there in the back of your mind.
Well, it certainly is. Our first and foremost consideration anytime we have fire is firefighter and public safety, and trying to make sure that we've taken the appropriate means to consider how to engage a fire so that we don't put our own firefighters at risk, and we certainly didn't want to put the public at risk. And as Becky denoted there, I think what I really appreciated was on July 4th, when that fire did crest up on the ridge, Metro conducted probably one of the most efficient evacuations of the mountain that one could ever experience. As a matter of fact, in my career, it's the most efficient I've ever seen. And so a lot of credit given to the residents as well as Metro for the orderly evacuation there. But nonetheless, yeah, what's weighing in your mind is that we had just lost almost an entire 20-person hotshot crew, which is our most elite fire crews. And so you want to make sure that, again, you're understanding conditions and the severity.
It took about 8 weeks to bring it fully under control. Did you ever think it was going to take that long?
Well, we actually did. You know, we brought in a national incident management team because of the high priority of the fire and the values at risk. They anticipated that it would likely be able to be contained by the middle of August, but they knew that up in what we referred to then as the Goat Rocks, which was those higher limestone cliffs there on the top of the ridge, that it was going to be very difficult to access safely. Therefore, we couldn't get firefighters into it again. But they also knew that it didn't pose a great risk because it was well buffered by rock and talus slope, as well as we had contingency lines in. So it did continue to put smoke up until we got some of those more torrential monsoonal rains.
We are talking about Mount Charleston, a year minus a day after the Carpenter One fire. We have been talking with a resident of Mount Charleston, Becky Grismaneskis. Randy Swick was the U.S. Forest Service manager of the Spring Mountains Recreation Area. In a few minutes, we're going to talk to Bruce Boyd, who is a butterfly expert, about the Mount Charleston blue butterfly and how it has fared in the years since the fire. Jim Hurria is with us as well. He joins us now. He's a soil scientist for the U.S. Forest Service. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. You're one of the leaders of the rehabilitation team, and 8 weeks in, the fire was contained. But when you first got on the mountain, what did you see after all of this was done?
Well, we saw a lot of areas that actually had been burned completely of vegetation. One thing that we actually did is I assembled a team that actually did an assessment of the post-fire effects or the damage to the actual areas that had been burned. And we actually called in different resources, soil scientists, hydrologists, wildlife biologists, archaeologists, wilderness specialists. Nearly 70% of this fire burned in wilderness. And so what we did was we did an assessment on that team just to see how severe did the fire actually burn. And through mapping that we actually did, through satellite mapping, we actually did an initial assessment, and they actually went on the ground to determine how severe did this fire burn. And that actually included, but what we did find was that most of the fire basically burned what we call a moderate severity. And anything moderate severity or high severity, basically a lot of vegetation is destroyed, and it also means the with the loss of ground cover, you have run the risk of flooding. That's one thing that we did talk to the town board for, is the fact that we assessed this thing and we said that the emergency is not over when the fire's out, because we know there's still an emergency with post-fire effects. And what we saw was a lot of basically destroyed vegetation, and most of this fire burned on very steep slopes, a lot of stuff that we can't do actually treatments for. And when the assessment team came out, they recommended some treatments, and they actually came out before the fire was even out. They actually came in July and August, and then we brought in an implementation team in September to start doing try to implement where we identified areas that we could possibly minimize or reduce the amount of damage to the soil resources and to the folks down below.
Now, ordinarily, if nature were left to her own devices with a fire like this, how long would it take for the area to recover?
Right now, the area is already recovering with some of the smaller vegetation, the shrubs, grasses, the aspens coming back. But when it comes to the trees and the larger trees, it's going to take decades.
And you were trying to help, as a soil scientist, trying to help speed that along a little bit.
Exactly. We wanted to try to minimize the loss of actual soil that could be productive to regeneration there, and actually try to get the stuff to regenerate.
Is there also a need to revive the forest in this area a little bit faster than nature would, because of the fact that people live there, own businesses, things like that? I mean, is that a factor when you're at work?
Not really. Right now, we look at assess, one of the things we do assess is the values of risk: threat to life, threat to property, threat to natural resources, soil and water, in addition to threat to cultural resources. Those are our four priorities. And so we look at that and try to say, okay, and these threats are to Forest Service, the Forest Service infrastructure, anything Forest Service property. And so what we do is we actually look at these assessments and try to say, okay, what can we do to minimize this and to help a recovery? Are there treatments out there that can actually speed up the recovery for these? The idea is to minimize the initial hazards. We know there's going to be post-fire hazards out there. Our idea is to actually minimize these impacts that could happen right away.
Now, Bruce Boyd is a butterfly expert, and he joins us too. Bruce, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Last year, you had said that fire, in some ways, might actually be good for the blue butterfly, the Mount Charleston blue butterfly. And I'm wondering about your take on the rehabilitation and how it has affected the butterfly.
Well, the rehabilitation is That's an unknown. I'm not sure what has been done. The introduction of non-native species, plant species, to rehab those areas could have short and long-term effect. And if I said the fire could be beneficial to the blue, that would be in the long term.
Short term,
fire is never good for butterflies
or
caterpillars. They don't crawl fast enough to deal with fire.
Sure. In terms of rehabilitation, what do you think is the right way to go about it on the mountain? What would you like to see in the next few years?
You know, we're in a 14 plus year long term drought. We're in the Mojave Desert. The species that I'm concerned with, or the ecosystem as a whole, has remained viable for millennia. I hate to use that word. It's become so overused. But with the introduction of non-native plants that are just promote fire, and displacing natural habitats of a multitude of different species, not just the Mount Charleston blue. It's a crapshoot. We don't know where this is going to go. Fire is part of a natural system.
Well, speaking of not knowing where it's going to go, the Mount Charleston blue, as a lot of us know, is a very rare butterfly. And it's not as though you can just hike up on the mountain and count them and there you are. What's your take on it? Do you think the Mount Charleston blue has survived?
Well, the Mount Charleston blue at this point remains extant. Yes, it still survives. The condition of that larger population that occurred on the South Loop Ridge is a total unknown right now. And what I was about to say, that fire is part of a natural system. The system is no longer natural because of all of the invasive weed species that come in after a fire occurs. The system no longer functions as it did in the past.
So, Jim Hurria, when you're rehabilitating a mountain quickly without disrupting the species that have lived there for thousands of years, how do you go about doing that without, with a minimal invasion of non-native species, as Bruce is talking about?
You know, one of our treatments that we look at is to determine if non-native species occur out there. A lot of our concerns are when the fire suppression does actually occur, there's a lot of areas where vehicles have actually parked, helicopter landing spots, the trails, a lot of the lower elevations, and we actually have crews out there actually looking at these areas to see if any non-native species came in there. Cheatgrass is one thing it's basically impossible to control. It's been coming in. It's already out there in the lower elevations already, and it's moving up, and there's really extremely difficult to control that. The idea is for us to monitor it and see how fast it's spreading. We know it's spreading. We're just got to do is try to minimize that with either vegetation or other aspects of it. We know that when we did some areas up in the Kyle Canyon last September, we actually spread some straw mulch in areas that were more burned more severely, higher severe burn severity. And those areas, we actually spread some straw mulch on the ground, so it would actually help retard or absorb some of the moisture, reduce the infiltration, increase the infiltration of the soil, reduce the actual runoff. We know on areas in a severe thunderstorm, it still won't hold. But the idea is to help promote some of the seed that's regenerating in there.
We are talking about the Carpenter One fire that erupted last year on July 1st. If you are a resident of Mount Charleston or someone who visits Kyle Canyon in the Mount Charleston area frequently, we would love to hear from you. What do you make of this entire region a year after this fire began? With us, we have Jim Hurria, who is a soil scientist with the U.S. Forest Service, Bruce Boyd, who is a butterfly expert, who has written about the Mount Charleston blue butterfly, among many other things,
Randy Swick, manager of the Spring Mountain National Recreation Area with the U.S. Forest Service, and Becky Grismaneskis, who is a resident of Mount Charleston. Now, Becky, as you told us a few minutes ago, your home was inundated with flooding. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers designed a million-dollar structure that would divert the floodwaters, and then Clark County and the cities in Clark County refused to take responsibility for the project, so it's not going to be built. What's the aftermath of that? I mean, how do you and your neighbors feel about that?
Not good. And you know, this isn't just for the residents of the mountain. That's what is so sad about this. There is not an area in Clark County where residents and visitors have, they all come to the mountain. And of course, the mountain is not like it was, and we all know that. There are some hiking trails that won't be reopened for some time. The fact remains that the agencies are trying to take care of it. They're doing something about it. So now we have a situation where the flooding could be avoided. That you're correct. The Army Corps of Engineers approved this. The county, I believe actually it was Office of Emergency Management, put in a request to the state of Nevada, Office of Emergency Management. They, in turn, put in a request to the Army Corps. Everybody was jumping through the hoops to comply with everything that they needed to do and needed to get. So here we are. The Army Corps approves this funding, which, as you just said, is a lot of money. The Forest Service initiated the original engineering on the project. Army Corps came up, backed it up with their engineering. They have done soil tests. They did tamping, I believe was the word, tests, to make sure about the ground and the soil around this flood channel. So Clark County came in, and I don't know, did we all just assume that they were going to do the right thing? We all live in Clark County. But they didn't. Our commissioner voted it down. Well, not didn't vote it down. It didn't go for a vote. So now here we are. And here's the other thing. Army Corps planned this so that it, give or take, the project was going to take 25 days to do this. That's all. We're not talking about this big thing. This is not even a mile long. It's on the Forest Service property. They're willing to issue the use permit. So now they were going to start it in June, so it would be done by the 1st of July, give or take, when the monsoons hit. Well, here we are.
Yeah, we're on the door of the monsoon season.
Exactly.
What are you thinking at this point?
We don't know what's going to happen. You guys were talking before about what it's destroyed on the mountain, and I love that blue butterfly, I do. But there are so many other things. The Palmer chipmunk. This guy is indigenous to the mountain. They're not found anywhere else on the planet as well. Do you know I finally now have like four? There were so many that were killed in that flood. Of course there were. We had a whole tree of the rock squirrels, gone. They're gone. They were killed, of course. What about the fox, the coyote, the deer? Occasionally we get an elk. I mean, all these things. So now what's going to happen? The flood, not only is the flood threatening the residential section again, and God knows, there could be a serious death here. Not to mention injury and property. But what about all this other stuff that the flood is taking with it? Is nobody thinking about that? I mean, it's taken trees. It's taken more vegetation. It's putting more rock and silt where it's not supposed to be, where all these little creatures like the butterfly, all their habitats are also getting wiped out, not just the people.
Mm-hmm. Randy Swick, as you look at the mountain, at this point, a year later, and now, as Becky's noting, on the door of the monsoon season for 2014, mm-hmm. When you're focusing your concerns, I mean, where are they focused? What are you looking at that most concerns you about the state of things on Mount Charleston now?
Well, we have a number of actions that we're still dealing with in post-fire context. As Jim pointed out, we're still responding to some of the burned area emergency rehab opportunities on the mountain. We're also dealing with some of that post-fire flooding issue that Becky made reference to in our own accord because, you know, just like the residents that live on the mountain, there are recreation facilities that are at risk. We saw those debris flows come down off the side of the mountain and impact a couple of picnic areas. And so we are right now trying to establish our own flood protocols for making sure that we can maintain the public safety up there at the same time as trying to still provide for the recreational opportunities that the mountain provides. So, and like I said, I do want to certainly give great appreciation, you know, both during the fire and immediately after the fire, the tremendous outpouring of cooperation between multiple counties, state, other federal agencies on this fire has really been kind of the saving grace for us. And it also is what has allowed us, even in a post-fire situation, to continue to try and work together to try and find answers.
Now, we've had something close to 120 days of no rainfall. The conditions are very similar to last year. It's very hot. It's very dry. The wildfire risk is certainly there. How much does all of that weigh on your mind?
Well, it's a huge concern from our standpoint. You know, we haven't exactly had the lightning this year, so all of our fire starts to date have been human caused. That's always a concern. We actually have one fire that's still under investigation where incendiary devices were actually used along Highway 160. So from our standpoint, you know, whether it be somebody's carelessness with a campfire, which right now we have a current closure on, no fires, whether somebody gets loose with a firework, whether we end up with somebody's brakes getting hot coming down a hillside. I mean, there are so many different potential triggers. And so our caution just to everyone is to stay extremely careful. No campfires, no fireworks are allowed within the NRA boundaries or on public lands. And so it's just really important right now that everybody do their best to not give us that potential ignition.
Jim Hurria, how much would a fire or a flood damage the recovery efforts that you've been helping to lead? And just restoring things on the mountain.
Can you repeat that question, please?
Well, I'm just wondering, given all the efforts, you know, from straw mulch to a lot of the other steps that you've taken to restore conditions and, you know, allow things to grow back, but restore conditions on the mountain. If there's a fire this year or if there's flooding this year, how much does that set you back? How much damage would it do?
It wouldn't, for regarding to the actual post-fire rehabilitation from this, it wouldn't set us back because, because any new fire starts, we'll basically start the whole process, assessment process over. Each assessment is actually unique to that fire itself. We actually get funding for that fire to actually do rehabilitation work. We request the funding and get it. So if we have a new fire breakout, we'll do a new assessment, and if we see areas that we need to do treatments on, we'll actually bring in new people to actually do the assessment and actually new source of funding. So it wouldn't set us back at all.
Mm-hmm. Bruce Boyd, what's your major concern as you look at the wildlife on the mountain, from butterflies to... Well,
that is always my concern, yeah. is habitat, the environment. You know, post-fire, Kyle Canyon, you look up on those ridges where they're barren now, where they used to be forested with pine fir forest and aspen groves. Even that is going to elevate the temperatures in Kyle Canyon. I mean, with that sun baking down on those, there's no other way to look at it. So each one of these, the fire was a direct effect. Then you have all these indirect effects that persist for years, the flooding, the invasive weeds.
How does that flooding affect animal species?
Well, it probably minimally. The Mount Charleston Blue habitat that we're concerned with is on the South Loop Ridge primarily. The other two priority butterflies, Cassis checker spot, Marantz checker spots, are also at high elevation, should not be affected by flooding.
We did hear Becky talking about the variety of chipmunk, a species of chipmunk.
But I'm looking at it as the species as a whole, mm-hmm. rather than a localized event. Mm-hmm. I don't like to drive up Kyle Canyon and see road kills either. But it happens. And I look at things on more of a species level threat rather than localized threats.
So it sounds like with all of this, you saw plenty of localized threats, certainly.
But, oh, certainly, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But not necessarily species,
not
existential
species.
Threats.
No,
species.
Not species-wide.
Yeah. Becky Grzmanekis, how are you preparing this year for a repeat of last year, just in case? It's hot, it's dry.
Fire and flood.
Fire and flood.
Yes, that's a good question. We're going to have a barbecue again on the 4th, and you know, do what you do when you live on the mountain. But the same thing: have your emergency pack ready, have your animal carriers ready, and it's just what you have to do. The fire is such a I'm certainly not trying to call it old hat, but it's something that we're aware of when we move to the mountain. You have to be aware. You've got to know that threat is there if you move into a forest, and we all understand that. And quite honestly, the flooding, there's nothing we can do, nothing. You cannot construct anything on your property in most cases because you cannot redirect the flood onto somebody else's property, which is, of course, logical. You can't do that. The roads were so wiped out that even the county has seen fit to put up flood barriers while they are in the process right now of fixing the road, Rainbow Canyon Boulevard. And the one entry was totally wiped out, destroyed from the flood last September. You could get across, but that was it. If another flood would have come, I don't even know what would have happened.
So do you and your husband have an evacuation plan? You have the potential to pack bags very quickly.
Yes, we do. Mm-hmm. And when fire season begins, like I said, I refresh my the kitty carriers. I make sure my emergency file contains any new documents that I need for it to contain. And we have permission from the Forest Service. The residents do to park on the fire road. Should a flood, you know, be imminent or thunderstorms be forecast. And, you know, in the Weather Service, they've gotten just great to us lately, too, making sure that things are updated, that we're all aware of it, you know, emails and phone calls. So that's all good. That's all to help us. But we do move our vehicles. Every time I think there's even a dark cloud, we move our vehicles to the forest road. But we actually dug in, my husband and I, cleaned it out, got rock out of there, an area where all of us can pull our cars into. So we've done that in preparation, but that's about all we can do.
Are you and your husband, or are you and neighbors talking at all about this and thinking, you know, a few more of these and maybe the flatlands will be an option?
To be honest with you, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And my husband and I are both retired, and we're actually still in both decent condition, but my husband's had two knee replacements. And so we just can't do what we used to do. It has nothing to do with the flood and the fires, but it certainly has not helped matters any.
Mm-hmm. What are your neighbors saying?
Oh, well, nobody can believe that no one will do this flood channel. We're just like, what? We don't get it. Liability? You put liability for dirt on the coming out of the forest compared to property destruction and death? I don't get it. We don't get it. None of us do.
But you might be able to find people in the valley who would say, well, you know, this is one of the risks of living on
the floods. What happens when the county gets flooded? What happens when the city gets flooded? That we have agencies that take care of that. We pay taxes like everybody else does. We're not asking for money. The money's there. The labor's there. The property's there. All we're asking is that someone sign on the dotted line to take the responsibility, and they won't do it. Right now, we are working with the state of Nevada. I just pray to God Governor Sandoval sees fit to go through with this, because the state can help us as well. Like I said, nobody has to come up with any money. But the Army Corps is not going to wait forever. That money's going to have to go back to somebody somewhere. But it's flooding. We didn't ask for this. My husband and I had our property. We had the Clark County Flood Control come to our property and okay it before we built our house. We did everything we were supposed to do that other people do. And it was like, oh, that was a 100-year thing that happened years ago. That'll never happen again. Oh, yeah? Well, it did after a fire. Who knew?
Who knew? Randy Swick, given the experience of last year, how do you think your team would respond to another big fire? Are there lessons that you're going to put to work?
Well, yeah, we are currently fully staffed. We have great Southern Nevada cooperators in Nevada Division of Forestry, Bureau of Land Management, Park Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Clark County. And so, you know, our agreements are in place. God forbid that we get another fire like last year. But I am grateful that, again, we've got that kind of cooperation, that ability to respond to any number of points if we get a start. So hopefully we stay on top of it and are able to be successful in those initial attack endeavors. And we don't see a recurrence.
Randy Swick is the manager of the Spring Mountain National Recreation Area for the U.S. Forest Service. Jim Hurria is a soil scientist for the U.S. Forest Service. Bruce Boyd is a butterfly expert. And Becky Grisman-Eskes is a resident of Mount Charleston. Thank you all very much for joining us today.
Our pleasure. Thank you.